Welcome to episode of 199 of the GTR on 5G. It's the latest insight scoop on everything 5G. We cover six topics in about 20 minutes, and it's brought to you by More Insights and Strategy. I'm Will Talented, and joining me again this week is fellow analyst Anshul Sag. But before we get started, Anshul, you and I are approaching a pretty magical number next week, episode 200. And you and I have been talking about what we should do for that episode. I just want to let our viewers and listeners in and ask, please send us your feedback. Hit Anshul and I up on our Twitter X handles, our LinkedIn handles, our Facebook handles. He and I have some ideas on what we want to do, but we'd love to get the viewers and listeners to provide some input there. But with that said, I'm going to jump to my first topic. Yeah, a little last minute. Maybe we should have done this a couple of weeks ago, but you and I are just back from a lot of travel and we're getting caught up. I've got five client papers in flight. I know you've been like publishing research notes and Forbes articles almost daily. And I think we'll get into some of that on the podcast this week, but let me get started with my first topic. And so news broke recently about T-Mobile and they're going to get serious about fiber. Now they've been in certain regions with fiber, but this is a big deal. The company is investing nearly $5 billion in a new joint venture with KKR. And I believe KKR is a private equity firm to purchase Metronet. And what this is going to allow T-Mobile to do is obviously build upon its success with 5G fixed wireless access services with new access to fiber. And obviously they're going to monetize that. The details are a little thin right now. But this certainly makes a lot of sense because they have built an incredible franchise. It is the leading 5G FWA service in the United States. And so they want to build upon the momentum. So I think it's super, super smart. Another advantage in doing this is that it's going to provide T-Mobile with access to fiber to support backhaul. So as they continue to build out their connectivity footprint, in the United States, you've got to have fiber backhaul to those radio towers to make all of this stuff work. It's a lot of money. It's $5 billion, but I think the dividends that they could realize long term are huge. So I hope I didn't steal all the thunder there, but I know you've got some opinion and some insight on this one.
Sure. So what's interesting is I honestly hadn't heard of Metronet until this acquisition. Admittedly, I'm not a big wireline guy.
Yeah.
What's interesting is T-Mobile is doing this as a JV with KKR, like you said. But yeah. T-Mobile was actually spending $4.9 billion, $10 billion JV
for right.
Metronet. $10 billion is no joke. I'm really curious about what this means for them because they have they're expected to have 6.5 million customers by 2030. And because the KKR is already a minority investor in Metronet, they already own a good chunk of them. I'm just trying to figure out like what the strategy is. But I think the way I look at it, it sounds like it is maybe one of those things that's like a mimicry of what AT&T is doing with their fiber. Like you said, where they're having the fiber network because that's the best for wireline. But also it advantages them in their rollout of fiber and helps them with their application. Yeah. I think my biggest question is like, what are Metronet's coverage areas and what are their biggest markets? And from what I could tell, it's very Midwest centric. Looked like it was like Minneapolis, like Chicago, Indiana. So I'm not really sure like how big they are and whether or not they're really worth acquisition price, but it does seem like they're in quote over 250 communities, and it looks they're already in Texas as well as through a merger. So it seems like it's very much Midwest and Texas based. So we'll see what happens. Maybe they grow this brand to bigger areas. I personally am a huge believer in fiber. I think AT&T Fiber has really convinced me of that. I've lived in three different places with AT&T Fiber, and they've all been. Over the course of 7 years, I've had 3 hours of downtime, which is a uptime. So I really do believe in well-managed fiber being effective.
Yeah. Hey, I'm just going to read the tea leaves on this one, but Metronet is a regional player, But I believe that this gives T-Mobile, I want to say fairly an economic end to fiber. $5 billion is a lot of money, but relative to like when you look at, and we're going to talk about AT&T and their 2Q earnings, but the investment that, the overinvestment at times that AT&T is making in fiber, T-Mobile just doesn't have the same size bank account as AT&T. And starting with FWA Clay to T-Mobile's strengths with their spectrum holdings and that sort of thing, and using that spectrum and building that out. And then AT&T has been fiber first, and now they've recently launched their Internet Air. They've had a business service for some time, but they've added consumer to that. Based on each of these companies' strengths in their spectrum position, they execute, I think, to the right playbook. And I think this gives T-Mobile an opportunity to participate in fiber. And then I think with Metronet and Metronet's experience and access and work with all the different fiber solution providers, it's going to provide the structure that's needed to potentially grow Metronet from a regional to more of a national player with this joint venture. But time will tell. But yeah.
I was going to add, I looked into a little more things. So the guys at CNET, they actually gave a little more coverage. That Metronet's in 250 communities in 15 states. It's actually pretty broad-based. But yeah. What's interesting is that most Metronet service areas within those states are smaller cities.
Okay.
So what that means is Metronet is actually going to be a rural push.
And that fits you with T-Mobile's focus.
And what they need.
Yeah.
We build out their cell network in those rural areas. So what this really is this is a bandwidth push for rural internet. And if you look at like the cities, like the biggest cities that are covered are Aurora, Illinois, Des Moines, Iowa, Lansing, Michigan, Lexington, Kentucky, Rochester, Minnesota, and Tallahassee, Florida. These are all like tier two or smaller cities.
They're smaller metros.
It's all about serving the smaller metros. I think that's really what makes a lot more sense. And now at $5 billion, they're basically buying a fiber network to build up their rural.
And it kind of fits with their FWA focus, which has been very rural with all the additional programs that they're doing to drive connectivity and bridge digital divide and all that. So interesting. So I think there's a lot there. Hey, let's go to your first topic. And it's our friends at AST Space Mobile. And they announced on the 25th some more concrete details around their first commercial deployment. So I'm going to let you take it and then I'm going to jump in.
Yeah, we know they're building satellites for communication, mostly for 5G. And they announced that the successful completion of the first 5 commercial satellite called Bluebird. Bluebird satellite have communication arrays at 693 square feet and are ready for shipment to Cape Canaveral during the first week of August with a 7-day launch window in September. They're completed and they're shipping them to Cape Canaveral to be sent up to space. And they are going to put these 5 satellites in orbit. And they're going to have them to create 5,600 cells in premium low-band spectrum with a planned tenfold increase in processing bandwidth. And I'm just basically quoting this CEO. And they're looking to basically launch these to fill the commitments that they have with their cellular partners. They already have strategic investments from AT&T, Verizon, Google, and Vodafone, and also have a new contract award with the U.S. government through a prime contractor. The deal is lining up. The satellites are completed. Now it is time to set them into orbit and get them into correct orbit. They've already done this before. So this is not something that they need to figure out how to do. The launch just needs to go smoothly and the placement in low Earth orbit needs to occur. And hopefully it does. And we'll probably have updates when that happens. But this is a big thing. And I think from what I recall, I'm not a big follower, but I think their stock did pop quite a bit. We had it up 14% today. Yeah. And it was up like 20% the day before. So 45% in the past 5 days.
About $16 a share. And if you were 19 on it, it was at $2 at its lowest. Yeah, I spent time with the team there in Midland on a couple of occasions. I've actually walked through the clean room. I've seen how these satellites are designed, and it's incredible how the arrays fold up and into a container.
And look like on a crate, like it's, I mean, I know it's not small, but it looks like you just put it on the back of a truck.
Yeah, you do. And it's because that the way they've designed the antenna array to fold up, it's very efficient. And last time I was there, I walked the clean room with Abel, the CEO. And one of the aspects of the Bluebird design is that it is larger. That is concerning some people, but because it's larger and conversely, the antenna array is larger, it's going to require AST SpaceMobile to launch much fewer satellites than Starlink. And Starlink, they're estimating that they're going to need 2 of their smaller low Earth orbit satellites to complete their constellation. AST SpaceMobile is going to need a small percentage of that. I think the number is 100 or 150. And also what's really impressive in spending time with the company, I've been able to dig into its patent portfolio, and Abel, the CEO, actually has authored several of these patents as well. And the company has been working with Nokia with a souped-up version of its AirScale infrastructure. And when you put all of that together, it makes for a very compelling value proposition. And then you mentioned all the investment from the companies named. Vodafone hasn't formally announced their commercial deployment plans, but I do expect it to happen after the launch is achieved in September. One of the big challenges, and I know you follow SpaceX as well, they had an incident where they had a malfunction. And so that's put a crump in the schedule. It's probably going to back a lot of things out because they lost, I think, 20 or so Starlink satellites in this incident. And so hopefully that launch window in September will not move out. And our viewers and listeners, you know, should understand that, you know, a lot of this is dependent on the fact that they're using SpaceX to launch these AST SpaceMobile production Bluebirds into space. Now, I think there are plans in the future for AST to move away from Starlink because obviously there's competition there. But yeah, it's exciting. It's exciting for the company. I think it's exciting for NTN in general because having more competitors involved is a good thing. It's going to raise the water level. It's going to drive innovation. And you've got Amazon that's also focused on this as well. So we're truly in the space race. And so it's exciting. Congratulations to the AST SpaceMobile team for this important milestone. When reading the press release, they caveated the fact that this is also based on weather cooperating. So you got there are a lot of factors that are going on for them to get these 5 production satellites into space in September, but it is super exciting. But hey, with that, let's go to my second topic, and I want to talk about CrowdStrike and the big outage that occurred last Friday. And I did publish a Forbes article on this, and obviously CrowdStrike is a security company. And just, you know, to give everyone the Reader's Digest version on what happened, there was a flood update. Unfortunately, it was a bootstrap driver, which did not allow the remote reset or a patch to be pushed through, because all of this that CrowdStrike delivers is obviously SaaS, and it's cloud-based. What that did is it really impacted a lot of businesses that don't have necessarily savvy IT people to be able to address the situation. Delta was grounded for a number of days. Airports around the country experienced outages. I think you even reported Starbucks was having issues, right? So this was pretty wide ranging. And there is actually a congressional hearing that's occurring today with the CEO. By the way, CrowdStrike is headquartered in Austin, Texas, where I'm based as well. But it got me thinking as I published the Forbes article, and by the way, for viewers and listeners, go hit my X handle, go hit my LinkedIn handle if you want to read the article. I go into a lot of depth there, but it provides a learning experience for DevOps and how you manage updates. And it just got me thinking, is there a learning opportunity here for MNOs? Because a lot of what they do on the network side of things is software defined, and one error and you can bring down an entire network. So I think it's a learning opportunity for the cybersecurity industry, but I think it's a broader learning opportunity from a developer operations perspective. And certainly I think MNOs can learn from this example as well. So I'd love to ask your opinion, like where do you see telcos maybe learning something from this massive outage?
I think there's a lot of things to learn. Seems like Microsoft is starting to talk about revoking kernel level access to prevent something from this ever happening. I think they will be able to convince the European regulators that they should be able to do this, because they claim that the European regulators are the reason why they couldn't.
It's actually technically, Anshul, as I dug into this, it's not specifically kernel level access, but it's pipeline level access, which is, you're probably splitting hairs on that, but it was a very tight integration. And this is something that the company like CrowdStrike,
Windows kernel. So it's, the access is still not like directly affecting the kernel, but they're able to, they're at kernel level in terms of how they're able to affect the operating system.
Through the pipeline. Yeah. Right.
And there, as a result of that, causes a blue screen that's basically requires physical intervention. Right.
And by the way, up to 15 boots for many of these companies that experience that particular issue or CrowdStrike.
Yes. And the other thing is that Microsoft had to deploy, like Microsoft deployed a fix with a USB drive that you could plug in, but that requires physical level access. And so many of these systems are not their remote systems or their laptops. So like people had to go in and physically stack laptops over the weekend and work on thousands of PCs, tens of thousands of PCs. It was a nightmare for a lot of companies. But I think ultimately what this boils down to is there's something structurally broken, in my opinion, with CrowdStrike's implementation. And it sounds like they didn't really have the right processes in place, which is insane to me. I tweeted something out over the weekend about the CEO having been a part of McAfee's.
Yeah.
That happened a decade ago. And
by the way, I mentioned my Forbes article, so I gave you some props.
I'm not even the one who found that. I just saw it and I was like, oh, I looked at his LinkedIn. He was not with the company for much longer after that. But
he was the CTO at McAfee, as I dug into that.
Yes. CTO, and he was gone, you know, within 6 months.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that there's a lot of weird things that happened that shouldn't have happened. CrowdStrike is going to lose a lot of customers. I think the whole $10 Uber gift card was a really dumb idea.
But they pulled it back, dude.
The fact that they pulled it even worse, eat it at this point. I'm not being punny, but like, point. But it just shows you, like, CrowdStrike executive leadership is not strongest.
No, it's not. But I do think it's a learning opportunity for our industries beyond cybersecurity, and you know, certainly for the mobile network operators, because again, so much of what is done, especially in a 5G world, is software defined. I think there's an opportunity, and it could lead to tighter rigor, to your point, in ensuring improved resilience on mobile networks that we all rely on, and I rely on for the broadband that's supporting this video chat. I use T-Mobile's 5G FWA service here in Bastrop. But hey, let's move to your second topic. And you want to talk about Apple and a rumor that they may be ditching Qualcomm 5G modems next year.
Yes, this is a rumor that refused to die.
Uh-huh.
This was reported by none other than Ming-Chi Kuo. He is a lone leaker of Apple news. Also, a recent follower of me on Twitter, which I've been following that for years, and out of the blue, he followed me. A CrowdStrike thing happened. I thought it was funny. But yeah, he basically saying that they're going to move away from using Qualcomm's modems next year, and they're going to start in the iPhone SE and then move on to the 17 Slim. So what it sounds like is they're going to do this. They're going to be doing it in the non-flagship devices, the lower volume product, which if there are problems, it will reduce the impact on a company, but it'll allow them to, for the most part, trial it out. And I think that's a good move. The reality is, you know, that does have some impact on Qualcomm's business, but it will not be a complete transition. It will be a partial transition, which has always been what was expected of Apple. Qualcomm was actually already expecting that Apple would have moved away from them this year. But they had to delay that move. And the reality is Apple's not transitioning entirely. So they're going to have to continue to buy Qualcomm modems and continue to have to license Qualcomm IP. But I do think this will potentially, if it happens, be the final end of the relationship between Qualcomm and Apple. I also think that Apple will most likely not support millimeter wave, which is a downside for Verizon customers. But maybe they will down the road. I just think added cost that Apple doesn't think they probably need to bear. And it does complicate the modem and make RF more expensive. We'll see if they actually add a millimeter wave just for Verizon, because that's really the only carrier that cares about it now. I think in the long term, millimeter wave will actually be necessary in highly dense areas. But until then, I think that millimeter wave is going to be ultra premium feature, mostly for Verizon customers.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple obviously does want to keep Verizon, but Verizon does let OEMs put down millimeter wave now. Interesting rumor. It's been reported multiple times and sure. It failed to be true. I will say that I will see it when I believe it, and we'll see if it actually happens.
So I know this off the top of your head. So if they do start moving away from Qualcomm next year, it's 2025. How many years have transpired since they acquired that Intel business and started trying to work on their own modems? Has it been 3 years?
5 years.
5 years?
Yeah, I originally said it will probably take them anywhere from 4 to 5 years to make the transition, but it will have been 6 years by the time they actually do it.
That is a flipping eternity in the tech industry.
Yes, but 3 full smartphone generations, if you count a generation being 2 years with refresh.
Yeah, and over half a G, because these G transitions are about a decade in length. Wow, crazy. That guy seems pretty reputable. I hit his X handle and saw the number of followers. And yeah, it's super interesting. But hey, man, let's move to my third and final topic. And I want to talk about T-Mobile. And just for a little bit of context, I have served as a judge for the T-Mobile for Business Unconventional Awards. This will be the third year that I'm doing it. And it's a fantastic opportunity to highlight companies that are using 5G in very innovative ways. And obviously, this is T-Mobile for Business, so they're very focused on their enterprise customers, but they're also focused on their education customers and their government customer. And as a judge, last year, we awarded first place prizes to companies that included the Walt Disney Studios, Infosys, Boston Children's Hospital, and the City of Bellevue, Washington. And so the categories are the same this year. There are three areas. There's innovation and customer experience, innovation and employee enablement, and innovation in industry. And then for government and education, there's a fourth category that focuses on innovation and community. Now, the new wrinkle this year is that last year we actually had Malcolm Gladwell. And I'm sure a lot of people know who Malcolm Gladwell is. He's a pretty famous author. His first book was The Tipping Point. He writes about a lot of interesting angles with business and society and that sort of thing. He's also going to be our master of ceremonies this year. And there's going to be a new category called the Tipping Point Designation. And this is really highlighting and awarding the company that did the most to challenge the status quo and spark transformative change. This has been a lot of fun for me. This will be the third year. It's at Mobile World Congress, Las Vegas. And I think this event has allowed T-Mobile for Business to really find an event and really become a headliner and provide visibility for the growth and what they've done with T-Mobile for Business, because it's under Callie Field. It's been a methodical build, adding services that can better compete with the likes of Verizon and AT&T. But I have a lot of fun with this. One of the judges is the leadership for the customer service organization for TFB. And then there are two Brits that have been judges. One, Philippa, works for the Wall Street Journal Trust, which is their sponsored content side of their house. And then Matt Griffin, who is a futurist. And I like to call him a cheeky British brand. So we're getting the band back together for a third year. You'll be hearing more from me about this. I did publish a research note recently on the More Insight the Strategy website. So if you want to learn more, go check that out. If you are a T-Mobile for Business customer and you're interested in entering, you still have time. Entries are being accepted through the end of July. And if you have any questions, feel free to hit me on my LinkedIn or my Twitter handles, and I'll provide more information. But you may not have a whole lot to add there, but what do you think about all that?
No, I think it's good. I think it's good that they're continuing to do it and continuing to involve you, mobile industry expert, in their awards.
Thank you, my friend. Hey, let's go hit our final topic. We're running a little bit long, but we've had some great discussion on T-Mobile and CrowdStrike and AST. But you want to talk about AT&T earnings, so I'm going to let you take it away and I'll add some color.
Yeah, AT&T reported earnings earlier this week, and they basically had pretty strong earnings. The interesting thing is that they reported that their postpaid net adds were 419,000 and phone churn was 0.7%, which is the lowest recorded total for a second quarter. And basically what they're saying is that their core business is strong.
Mm-hmm.
They had $29 billion in revenue, which is actually down from a year earlier.
Slightly, not true.
Slightly. And that mobility revenue was $20 billion, which is just below the expected $40 billion figure. And that wireless service revenue was in line at $16 billion. So basically, they just nailed or just slightly missed both their targets. But the important things were that net additions were up and that they're actually 40% of their fiber customers are also mobility customers.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot of really good things. And I think that's why if you look at the stock, it went up on earnings, even though they missed.
Yeah.
Once again, earnings is not everything, but it's quite clear that AT&T is in a good place. And they're obviously going to have to work to eke out more margin out of these revenues. But ultimately, their stock was up 3% on the news. And
yeah.
Because their net adds are up and AT&T is doing their core business right. And I'm a proponent of them focusing on that business because ever since they got rid of their entertainment business, they've been doing really well.
Yeah, they've been focusing on what they're good at. And I think there are a couple other things to point out here for why they saw their stock price bump a little bit. Free cash flow improved nearly $500 million. Over last year. And when you look at their fiber net adds, that ran at 239,000. And so that marked 8 or 9 consecutive quarters of over 200,000 net fiber adds on a rolling basis. And so that really points to the strength of fiber that sort of underlies the mobility services for obvious reasons. And I think when you look at all of that and what you pointed out, and then you look at what they're doing with Internet Air and growing their fixed wireless access footprint for consumer and business, I think the latter gives them some nice upside as well. To your point, great execution, flat in some areas, but continued growth in fiber, which really points to the quality of what they're doing in fiber. And you just spoke to it. You've had 3 experiences in 3 different places you've lived in, and it's been fantastic. I had AT&T fiber in Austin when I was living there. Fantastic. Had very few issues with it. Performance up and down was great. And yeah, so it's great to see them executing on that. It is mobile network operator earnings season, so I'm expecting that on a future podcast, we'll be talking about others as well, like T-Mobile and Verizon. But with that, my friend, we ran a little bit long, but we had a lot of great conversation with wanting to take us home.
Absolutely. We hope our viewers and listeners found this week's topics interesting. If anyone out there would like to provide insights on a specific 5G topic for a future podcast, please reach out to us on social media, world.wellcontact, and I'm at OnShellFog. We hope you have a great weekend, and please tune in again next week, and don't forget to rate us and subscribe.